This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Sevilla Mann talks with a Western Michigan University researcher studying white nose syndrome, which can kill hibernating bats. But first, how much warmer can the Earth get before there are serious consequences? That's a question scientists have been debating, and a topic that Western Michigan University Professor of Biological Sciences David Corot plans to tackle as part of the Lyceum Lecture Series at Western. His address Wednesday at noon is called What's at Risk? 2 degrees versus 4 degrees warming. David Corot, thank you for being with us.
My pleasure. It's great to be here.
Let's talk about those two numbers. What's the significance, 2 degrees and 4 degrees?
4 degrees, really a little bit above 4 degrees, is the likely increase in global average temperature by the end of the century, 2100, if we continue on our current path.
4 degrees Celsius?
4 degrees Celsius, so 7-8 degrees Fahrenheit. The warming would be more than that in high latitudes, a little bit less than that in the tropics, more than that over land, less than that over the oceans, but on average about 4-4.5 degrees. If we don't make major changes in where we get our energy from, 2 degrees is sort of a compromise between what the scientific community thinks we should do and what the scientific community thinks we have a chance to do. 2 degree warming would be the result of shifting over fairly quickly and fairly extensively to alternate energy sources, non-carbon-based energy sources. And it corresponds to how much Earth would warm if we, by mid-century, got about 80% of our energy from non-fossil fuel sources.
And again, we're talking 2 degrees Celsius, so right. More like 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, something like that?
Right, exactly. Yep. Doesn't sound like much, but as a change in global average temperature, it's huge.
You mentioned there the idea that scientists would prefer something else. I mean, would scientists just prefer that we not warm at all?
Sure. Yeah. I think without question, the best alternative is to not allow Earth to warm. But that would require either major changes in energy infrastructure in a very, very, at a very rapid pace, which I think is possible. It's just not something that we're, as a species, entertaining as a reasonable possibility now. Or it would require manipulating the climate in some other way. We don't have good ways to do that yet. We have ways in which, in theory, we could cool the planet, for instance, putting reflective surfaces in high in the atmosphere or on the ocean, essentially mirrors that would bounce sunlight back out to space before the surface of the Earth could convert it into heat. But those are highly theoretical at this point. There's nothing that we are close to being able to implement.
When we talk about this 2 degrees or 4 degrees warming, what's our base point here? Where are we starting from? Are we starting from now, or are we starting from a ways back and saying that, you know, the temperature has warmed and it would warm more to get to this 2 degree point?
That's a really good question. It depends which paper you are reading. Most of the recent papers use as their baseline the average temperature of the Earth from 1980 to 2000. So essentially warming from now. In 1980, Earth was about 7/10 of a degree Celsius warmer than before the Industrial Revolution. So it doesn't make too much difference. What you use as your starting point is about 7/10 of a degree difference.
So what is the risk if the Earth does get 2 degrees warmer? What are we looking at in terms of changes that we might face as people, as a human species?
Right. The way I'm going to talk about this subject on Wednesday, I'm going to actually try to take a relatively optimistic or hopeful viewpoint. And what I'm going to do is talk first about what our current pathway, what consequences there will be of our current pathway for 4.5 degrees, and then talk about how what we would gain by limiting warming to 2 degrees. A necessary conclusion is that 2 degrees is not without adverse consequences. I mean, there are problems with 2 degrees, but there are way more problems with 4-4.5 degrees. For instance, if we allow Earth to warm as we are currently doing, so that it reaches 4 degrees by the end of the century, that will likely result in about 400 million more people at risk of getting malaria, mostly in Africa, although some actually in the southern United States. If we limit warming to 2 degrees, we cut that number in half. So one of the ways to look at the benefits of shifting over to alternate energy sources is that we prevent potentially 200 million cases of malaria a year. Another way to look at it is that heat waves, of course, would be less frequent, less intense, less, they would have be of shorter duration, and as a consequence, less lethal. So, for instance, a prediction is that with 4.5 degree warming, Boston is likely to have about 1,100 deaths per year due to heat waves. If we keep warming to 2 degrees, that's less than 400 per year. So we save over 700 people a year just in Boston alone. And those are, I think, important ways to look at the benefits of the choice we have. The choice we have is, do we continue to use fossil fuels the way we have, or roughly the way we have, or do we make a very concerted effort to shift over to safer, really saner energy sources? And the focus has largely been on the cost of shifting from, you know, business as usual to a different lifestyle, different source of energy. I think the emphasis should be more so on the benefits of doing that. And that's what I'll try to present on Wednesday. And we can measure those benefits in all kinds of ways. It's relatively easy to measure it in terms of benefits to human health. For instance, reduced deaths due to heat stress, reduced malaria. There are other human health benefits that are harder to quantify. I think the probability of armed conflict is much greater if we allow Earth to warm 4 degrees than 2 degrees. It's hard to quantify exactly what it is.
Well, why do you think that? What's the theory behind that?
Because 4 degree warming results in much more frequent, severe, prolonged droughts, which cause crop failures. And in much of the world where subsistence agriculture is the way of life, crop failures mean that it's very difficult to survive. And those kinds of stresses on human societies almost certainly will result in some increased level of armed conflict. Resources become much scarcer. So if you don't have them, but your neighbor does, you have little choice but to try to use force to gain them. That's the idea anyway. And the climate-related events that precipitate conflict would be much reduced at 2 degree than relative to 4 degree. And then there are other consequences, for instance, for ecosystems. I mean, it's very hard to make a global prediction about extinctions, but our best estimate at this point is that if we allow Earth to warm about 4 degrees, we probably will lose close to 40% of all species on the planet. If we keep warming to 2 degrees, it's more like 10% of species. So you can think of shifting from coal to solar and wind to generate electricity helps us save 30% of Earth's species from extinction. It's a very rough estimate, but it's likely to be somewhere in that ballpark.
There have been a number of articles. There was a study from researchers at the University of California, San Diego, saying that it's really probably past the point that we can limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius over the next however many number of years you want to pick, that we're going to go past that. What do you say to that? Do you think that it is difficult?
Oh, it's difficult. But it really requires a concerted global effort. It can't be done by one country. It has to be done by an international coalition, especially of the major carbon emitters, which are Europe, China, United States, India. But the developing countries are emitting now a substantial portion of carbon, so they have to be involved too. But we have the technologies to stop using almost all fossil fuels quite quickly if we wanted to. It just would, we see it as disruptive and therefore undesirable to do that. But if we had no choice, if we knew without a doubt, for instance, that our planet would be irreparably changed such that it was not suitable for human habitation if we didn't do something within 10 years, if we didn't stop using fossil fuels within 10 years, what would we say? Would we say, well, we can't do that, so I guess our planet is gone? Or would we say, we'll do it in 5 years? And I think we would say we'll do it in 5. We know that we have the capacity. We just don't have the will to do it yet. Coal is the easiest fossil fuel to abandon, to replace. We have other ways of generating electricity, solar and wind, that actually, if you include the health costs of using coal, these alternate energy sources for electricity turn out to be less expensive per kilowatt hour. So we have technologies that are even economically feasible.
Well, the question, though, is often raised, are these technologies able to produce as much energy as we produce right now?
Right. Yeah, one of the falsehoods that is quite common is that, for instance, wind and solar are either incapable of producing the amount of electricity we want or incapable of producing a consistent, reliable stream of electricity. Both of those.
Because, for instance, there are days when we don't see the sun. Sure. So are we able to get energy on a day when it's very overcast and not much sunlight's available?
Right. It's an argument that on the surface sounds reasonable, but it's not. Solar energy. So all you really need is some way of storing energy while you're making it in excess of what you're using at that point, and then being able to tap that when you're not making it currently. So with solar, not photovoltaics, but the solar thermal techniques, so the kinds that are used in big utility scale solar farms, for instance, in our Southwest, basically differ from a coal-fired power plant only in where the heat is coming from to make steam. Okay, both of them generate steam. The expansion of steam drives turbines that generates electricity. In a coal-fired power plant, we get the heat from burning coal, and as a consequence, put a lot of carbon into the air and other particulate matter and so on that harms people downwind. In a solar thermal utility scale installation, we just use the sun to make the heat. You focus the sun's rays on a material that can heat up to, let's say, 1200 degrees Celsius, and you use that heat to make steam. And from that point on, it's the same as a coal-fired power plant. You use the steam to drive a turbine that generates electricity. So on sunny days, for instance, in the Southwest, those installations can make so much heat that they can't possibly use all the electricity they could generate at the moment. All that's required is a heat reservoir, for instance, buried in the sand right next to the tower, that can store excess heat during the day, and then all night long you can make steam, and if you can make steam, you can make electricity. So it's a very simple fix. And people who spread the argument that solar is no good because it can never be our sole source of electricity because it's an intermittent source, actually know that that's not true.
So if we do go past this 2 degrees Celsius threshold, or even worse, go past the 4 degrees Celsius threshold, are there ways to reverse that and bring the temperatures back down?
In theory, yes. So they fall into a category called geoengineering solutions. And the most promising, although it's still nowhere near close to even being demonstrated on a small scale, but still the most promising category is manipulating the solar budget of the Earth. So basically taking the only natural factor that we know has been responsible for Earth's climate changes in the past and manipulating it, basically bouncing sunlight back to space before it can hit a surface and heat up that surface. You know, light energy gets converted into heat energy when it hits a surface. That's why we sunbathe. And so in theory, we could reflect some of it back, but we have no idea what the consequences would be of putting mirrors in space or small, very small reflective particles in the stratosphere or ionosphere or wherever. It I think has to be seen as a very last-ditch attempt to rescue the planet. We have better ways to do it. And we can create jobs. We can clean up our air. We can save lives. We can make Earth a better place in many ways, in addition to keeping the climate from changing so much that the planet becomes very difficult to inhabit.
David Corot, thank you very much for your time.
Sure. My pleasure.
David Corot is a professor of biological sciences at Western Michigan University. His address titled, What's at Risk? 2 Degrees versus 4 Degrees Warming, is part of the Lyceum Lecture Series. His talk is scheduled for noon on Wednesday in Western Michigan University's Lee Honors College. A link with more details and more from David Corot, including his thoughts on Western Michigan University's sustainability practices, can be found at WMUK.org.
West Southwest. I'm Sevilla Mann. We're speaking today with Martin Vonhoff, an associate professor of biology at Western Michigan University. Vonhoff is in the midst of studying a potential remedy for white nose syndrome. It's a fungal disease that has devastated U.S. and Canadian bats since it first appeared 9 years ago in New York State. In some species, it's close to 100% fatal. Vonhoff explains how white nose syndrome changes bats' behavior and the possible treatments he and other scientists are exploring. What's not understood yet about white nose syndrome and the way it works? For example, is it understood how it kills the bats?
So a paper actually just came out in the last 2 months that tried to kind of provide a model of, you know, the physiological changes that occur in affected bats. And essentially, what happens is, you know, the fungus grows across the skin of a hibernating bat. A hibernating bat is sitting just above freezing, you know, and it's barely functioning physiologically. And certainly, you know, hibernating bats don't mount an immune response because their immune system is suppressed while they're in that state of torpor, we call that. So the fungus grows across the skin. It starts to invade the tissue. And bats during the course of a normal hibernation bout, you know, an uninfected bat will actually wake up every, you know, 1 to 2 weeks. And one of the hypotheses as to why they do that is so that they can actually have their immune system kick in, essentially. And so we think what happens is that, you know, as the fungus starts to invade their tissues, the bats start to arouse more. And when they arouse more, then they have an inflammatory response, just like you and I have when we get a cut or something like that. We get that very kind of red skin around the wound. It feels kind of hot. And that inflammatory response can actually cause damage in the tissues of the bats. And so they end up getting kind of holes in their wings. They start feeling bad because they're having this inflammatory response. They start to lose fluids. It starts to change their blood chemistry. And they're arousing more because of this bad feeling, and so they start burning up a lot of the energy that they require to make it through hibernation. So it's this kind of combination of, you know, changes to their blood chemistry and the amount of fluid they have in their body and the loss of energy reserves that they have. And so then they start behaving very funny. You know, in the middle of winter with snow on the ground, the bats will start flying around, probably looking for access to water and maybe food to replenish their energy, and usually they don't make it then.
Now, your current research looks not so much at white nose syndrome itself, but how you might fight it. Is that correct?
Yeah. So, you know, every bat biologist in the world, you know, who has spent their, you know, career studying bats wants to do something to help bats and come up with solutions or management strategies that will have some impact. And so I have a compound that I'm testing. It's called chitosan. And it's derived from the shells of crustaceans and insects. And it is biocompatible, you know, biodegradable compound that we could apply very widely to bats. And it has two very important features. It's antimicrobial, so it acts against the fungus. And so in our initial tests, if we grew up the fungus in the presence of chitosan, we saw an 84% decline in the growth of the fungus. And if we just take fungal spores and try and grow them in the presence of chitosan, they don't germinate at all, essentially. So it has this very strong inhibitory effect on the fungus, and at the same time, it has important wound healing properties. And so if you put chitosan onto a wound, it will aid in all stages of wound healing. It will accelerate it, and very importantly, it will minimize that inflammatory response. And so this combined effect makes it, you know, very appealing to try on bats. And so what we're doing right now is doing this under controlled conditions, essentially in the lab.
Yeah, so you've got some bats that you said are in a sort of artificial hibernation right now?
Yeah, that's correct. So we went to northern Michigan, and we collected bats in the fall when they'd entered a mine to go into hibernation, and we brought them into the lab. And then we experimentally infect the majority of them with the fungus, so we give them the disease, and then we treat them with varying amounts of the compound, chitosan, and we tried out different timings of application as well. So we, you know, did some right at the beginning while the bats were still warm and active, and so we let them, you know, spend time grooming and being active while this compound was on them. Another set of bats, we treat them after a month of being in hibernation. And so we're trying to mimic what we might do, you know, in nature with this compound. You know, if we want to apply this to bats, we're either going to go out while the bats are still active and try and spray them, you know, with the compound, or we're going to go into the hibernaculum while they're hibernating, and we're going to spray this compound on them. And so we're testing these kind of timings and different dosages in the lab.
Do you ever go and peek at them?
One of the fun things that we have in our experiment is that we wanted to make sure that we could monitor the bats on a daily basis, you know, just to ensure that nothing was going wrong and that they were healthy. And so in our incubator, we've got thermal infrared cameras. And so I can go online at any point and see how my bats are doing.
Can you tell at all on the camera whether some of them have died from the fungus?
When bats are feeling sick due to the fungus, they tend to separate themselves. So, you know, hibernating bats normally form clusters. They are in very close proximity to one another in that cage, right on top of one another. But when they get sick and are, you know, on that path to death, they tend to separate themselves. So they'll kind of crawl to a different part of the cage. And so you can definitely tell when somebody's not doing very well.
And have you seen that at all?
Just in the last week, we've had two bats in our infection control group, the group that is infected with the fungus that doesn't receive any treatment with chitosan, and they have died. And we've had one bat in one of the chitosan-treated cages that has also died. And this is not unexpected because, you know, we've taken these bats out of nature, we've brought them into an artificial environment. Along the way, we had to handle them, you know, we had to manipulate them while we infected them with the fungus, you know, or while we treated them with chitosan. And so, you know, we've already asked a lot of these bats in terms of their energy stores. And so whenever we hold animals in an artificial environment, you know, sometimes some of those animals die.
Now, remind me how much longer this goes on before they all wake up and you take a look at them?
Yeah, so the plan is to let the experiment go until early March. So we'll have a 6-month total length to our experiment. And then we collect the bats at the end, and then we have to do a lot of work to understand how much fungus they had growing on their wings. So is chitosan limiting the growth of the fungus, essentially? And we can do that using genetic techniques. We can do that using histological techniques, where we actually examine the wing tissue under a microscope. And so that takes some time, but at some point this summer, we should have some answers.
Is chitosan one of many compounds that researchers are trying out to see if they fight the fungus, or is it kind of the one great hope for fighting it?
All of us are probably familiar with the fact that there are antifungal compounds, and The issue with those is that they tend to be very expensive and they tend to be highly toxic, actually. So if they're ingested, even by a human, we tend to get sick from them. And so, you know, pretty early on, some testing was done of some of those compounds, and indeed some of them are very active against the fungus. But, you know, how are we going to put these out into natural environments? It's just not a feasible solution. And so in the last 2 or 3 years, there's been kind of a three-pronged approach. You know, different groups have come up with different ideas. And so chitosan is one approach that, you know, I and my colleagues are pursuing. But there are two other groups that are investigating other possible solutions. And so one of those is looking at probiotics, essentially. So taking naturally occurring bacteria on the wings of bats and growing them up and determining whether they produce compounds, metabolites, that act against the fungus. And so they've done this, and they found that indeed there are some bacteria that naturally occur on bats that completely inhibit its growth. And so then the idea is, okay, well, you grow up more of that fungus, and then you augment essentially the bats with these naturally occurring bacteria. You're just increasing their population size, but that may have, you know, an inhibitory effect on the growth of the fungus. So that's one really interesting way that people are trying to go about that. The other way is a group that normally studies the fungal spoilage of produce. And so they have cultured bacteria that normally occur in the soil that produce volatile compounds, so compounds that will be released into the air. And so they tested these compounds on the fungus that causes white nose syndrome, and again, they found very strong inhibitory effects. And the neat thing about that approach is that you don't even have to have the bacteria touching the fungus or applied to the wings of the bats.
You would put the compound near the bats, and then that would produce the volatile compounds, and then that would be enough to get rid of the fungus rather than having to go in and apply it to the bats.
Absolutely. I mean, that is the one downside of our approach using chitosan is, okay, if it, you know, all indications are that it has a strong inhibitory effect, but we have this issue of delivery. How do we get it out to, you know, hundreds of thousands of bats that, you know, may be infected with this fungus? And, you know, there's a real kind of logistical consideration there. And that logistical consideration is there for other approaches as well. You know, for the probiotic approach, they would have to, you know, somehow apply these bacteria to bats. The benefit of the volatile organic compound approach is that, you know, you could just apply it to the air within these hibernacula, and then, you know, bats, you know, by the very nature of contact with the atmosphere, you know, may be exposed to those compounds. The downside of that approach is that many volatile organic compounds are also toxic. And so you have to find the right concentrations where it's not going to cause illness in the bats, but at the same time limit the growth of the fungus.
Has there been any indication that bat populations, even the ones with a really high mortality rate from white nose syndrome, that they're developing any kind of resistance to the fungus?
So in infected areas, if you go, you know, to northern New York, to Vermont, you know, the original kind of locus of the disease, there are still bats there of the highly affected species. So there are little brown bats and northern long-eared bats that somehow survived the original kind of passage of the disease through that area. And of course, then there's a lot of interest in trying to figure out, well, what makes those bats different from the other ones that did die? And so people are definitely pursuing that.
Dr. Martin Bonhoff, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're very welcome.
Martin Bonhoff is an associate professor of biology at Western Michigan University. You can hear WMUK's full interview with Bonhoff at our website, wmuk.org.